The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next, number 86495, Kmart Corporation against Cartel. Very well, Mr. Cohen, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The parties to this case agree that Section 526 protects a U.S. trademark owner against importation of goods bearing its mark that were manufactured abroad by some other firm, even if that other firm has the legal right to use the mark in the foreign country. Respondents brought this lawsuit to establish that Section 526 also does something quite different, namely, entitle the U.S. trademark owner to bar importation of goods that it itself, or a company under common control, manufactured, stamped with the trademark, and sold into commerce abroad. We disagree. Our central point is this. Substantive U.S. trademark law does not give a trademark owner any right to restrain the distribution of its own goods after sale. Section 526 was designed to correct a judicial mistake that allowed the importation of infringing goods that had been manufactured by somebody else. It need not be read as having also given the trademark owner an anomalous, even revolutionary, new right to bar importation of its own genuine goods, which could be sold in this country by anyone without infringement, if only they can get across the border. To take a particular example, General Motors can stop anybody else from making a car and selling it as a Chevrolet. But as this court made clear in the Prestonetz case and in the Champion Spark Plug case, and as Judge Sneed explained for the Ninth Circuit in the recent Neck Electronics case, and as most of us know from experience, anyone, apart from contract rights, can sell a used, genuine Chevrolet with the Chevrolet logo on it without General Motors' permission. We think Treasury properly concluded that Congress did not inadvertently give General Motors, which has no right at all to restrain the further distribution of a Chevrolet it sells in Maryland, a right to dictate that a car it has sold in France may never enter this country. Section 526, as its legislative history makes clear, and as learned hands said in 1923 in the LeBlum case, was intended to do something quite modest. Since the 19th century, U.S. law has barred importation of goods bearing simulated U.S. trademarks applied by someone other than the U.S. trademark owner. In 1921, in the Katzel case, the Second Circuit held, quite erroneously, that French goods bearing a mark affixed by the person who was entitled to affix that mark in France were non-infringing and could be imported into this country even though someone else, unrelated to the French company, owned that mark in this country. This court promptly corrected the Second Circuit, but not before Congress had dealt with the casus omissus, as Judge Hand called it, by adopting Section 526 to make clear that even if a mark has been lawfully applied abroad, the goods that bear it may be denied importation if somebody else owns the mark in this country. There is just no evidence that anyone wanted to give a multinational enterprise, be it General Motors or Honda or Pears Soap, the power to block importation of genuine goods it itself sold abroad. And so Treasury, reading the statute in its legal and historical context, interprets it as not referring to a mark applied abroad by the very U.S. trademark owner who now seeks to exclude the goods, or his affiliate, or his licensee. Respondents' arguments come down, I suggest, to a contention that the text does not allow that reading. But in fact, it is the kind of reading that this Court has often given to statutes, even without the benefit of the long regulatory history that we have here, where a statute has a narrow reading that is perfectly consonant with its text and its legislative history, and there is also a broader reading that the words might literally bear, but which would work an implausible change in the settled legal context, this Court has not hesitated to decline on contextual grounds to give the statute a broad literal reading. That's what happened in O'Connor, the Puerto Rican, the Panamanian treaty case, when the Court said that the words any tax do not refer to U.S. taxes, because an exemption from U.S. taxation would be too implausible to have been what the draftsman meant. The Court did the same thing in Watt against Alaska when it said that the term minerals in wildlife refuges do not include minerals in reserved lands, but only in acquired lands, even though wildlife refuges were defined to include both reserved and acquired lands, because the context suggested that that's not what Congress meant. It's what the Court did in the 1940 American Trucking Association's case when it said that the term employees of motor carriers referred in context, not in the context of anything else in the statute, but in the context of the general background of the law, to employees in safety-related jobs. It's what the Court did in the Guerra case when it said that the statute saying that pregnant women shall be treated the same as other employees set a floor and not a ceiling, meant they should be treated no worse, but not no better, because Congress wasn't worried about the problem of excessively favorable treatment of pregnant employees. It's what we all do when we assume that the words "no sleeping in this railway station" do not mean that it is illegal to fall asleep while waiting for a train. Since, I think at the very least, there is no unambiguously expressed intention of Congress to give a trademark owner the help of the Customs Service in excluding its own goods.
Why is that not unambiguously expressed?
Well, because...
I'd like to think that, but why is that not unambiguously expressed?
Because the statute does not, I think, focus on the precise question at issue. It says that goods that bear a trademark, registered and so forth, may not be imported without the consent of the U.S. trademark owner, but it does not, I think, answer the question whether the term bears a trademark there means to refer to a trademark that has been applied by the very person who now seeks to exclude the goods.
So when we have a general statute, it is ambiguous as to each of the specific instances that its language covers.
No, when you have a general statute, there is room for for interpretation. I think when the Court has said a statute speaks to the precise question at issue, it's really meant, does the statute focus on that question, the statute did in the Dimension Financial case, when there is a definition that is aimed at precisely the question the Court is trying to answer. Here, the words leave open the question whether that is what Congress meant by the word.
They cover the situation. You acknowledge that. The words cover the situation. Your point is simply that the words do not say, well, in essence, you're saying we have a statute that says all colors.
They cover the situation.
We have a statute that says all colors, but you're saying, yes, but the statute does not say including red.
They cover
right?
the situation.
That's essentially your argument.
No. I think in that case you would say that somebody deliberately focused on how many colors. Here, we have a statute that, like a statute that says any tax and is held not to include U.S. taxes or not, as in the more recent case.
We relied on other contexts, on other language and context of the statute in that case. We just didn't say, as far as we know, Congress didn't focus on this particular tax. We relied upon the rest of the statute.
The basic reason for the reading the Court reached in that case, after saying there was I believe the phrase was some textual evidence, albeit subtle, the basic reading that the Court reached was based on the legal context in which the statute was written and the implausibility of the conclusion that Congress meant to cover a case that there was no sign that it had deliberately adverted to. Or in that case, the draftsman of the agreement. There has to be room to say that words that can apply generally, words like employees in the Motor Carrier Act, which have a commonly understood meaning, nevertheless don't necessarily have their full reach. And it has to be possible, it seems to me, to say that where there is no evidence that anyone adverted in the drafting to the particular question at issue, that one can look at context, and there is also room, it seems to me, then for a regulatory interpretation as well. It seems to me that this
is... Is the ambiguity here in the term bears? Or is it ownership and domicile?
I think.
Or is it in the whole thrust of the statute?
Well, I think it is in the whole thrust of the statute, but I think the way I would prefer to say it is, the question is whether bears a trademark means to include the case where the trademark was applied by the very person who now seeks to exclude the goods, or whether that is a case that is outside Congress's concern, just as treating pregnant women more favorably than other employees is not within what Congress meant when
it said
treat them
the same. Well, I thought if there is one given constant in this case, it's the word trademark, and it's the ownership and the domiciliary of the trademark holder that's in question.
I think that...
Or are you saying that trademark itself is ambiguous?
I think that the question is whether the statute applies to exclude goods bearing a trademark that it has been applied by the same person who now seeks to exclude them. It is.
But the statute doesn't say that anyone can exclude a trademark. It says that the owner and the domiciliary can exclude it. Can exclude the goods bearing the mark.
Well, yes. And The very fact
it seems to me that that's the focus of the statute.
Well, it's the very fact that the statute limits the power of exclusion to a U.S. owner, and indeed to goods of foreign manufacture, is, I think, some textual evidence that Congress's intent here was simply to give a U.S. owner who was separate from the foreign manufacturer of the goods the power to exclude those goods because they infringe his trademark over here. I don't think those limitations make any sense if what we're talking about is a general right of a trademark owner to control the distribution of its own goods. Most U.S. trademark law does not draw any distinction between U.S. citizens and other
persons. So one of your major propositions is that bears a trademark is an ambiguous phrase?
I think that the question whether the whole statute reaches this case, as Treasury has said, I think since 1936, certainly since the mid-40s, is the question on which the statute is ambiguous.
Well, then it seems to me the question may become whether the regulation so transcends whatever ambiguity is there that there's no statutory anchor for it.
Well,
is that the issue in the case?
I think that the question, no, I think that what the regulation does is to say this is a statute that was written to fill a hole to enable a U.S. trademark owner to keep out goods that are infringing here but are genuine abroad. The question is whether that statute also does something that the petitioner in the Prestonetz case described from this podium 63 years ago as revolutionary, and the court agreed with him, namely to give the U.S. trademark owner a chance, a means of restraining the distribution of its own goods. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Our position that Section 526 is broad enough to entitle the Customs Service to give it the construction which it has done for at least the past 50 years is based on, we think, three factors. One is the use of, and the particular addition, of specific statutory language, and that is the language dealing with ownership by an American corporation. The legislative history makes it clear that that specific language was put in conference after the Senate debate, which ended with some uncertainty about the Pears soap hypothetical, which is close precisely to the situation presented by the present litigation. And it's subsequent to that time that the conference determined to make it clear that what Congress was protecting in 1922 were American owners. And American owners of trademarks, we submit, does not include and was never intended to include a multinational foreign corporation which could set up a wholly owned American subsidiary. And that brings us to the second, as it were, ambiguity in this statute which entitled Customs to arrive at the result, which is that the statute was enacted in 1922. and in our supplemental memorandum, we've quoted for the court various references that were made at that time. And it was a time when the corporate layering that is now customary was, we submit, in its infancy. That at that time, Congress was not contemplating foreign, wholly owned subsidiaries. It was that kind of a corporate structure was something to which the courts were ready to look through and say you weren't an American owner. You weren't the owner, the real owner, was whoever the corporate parent was. So we think the history is important. The plain language principle, we think, looks to what Congress would have had in mind at the time. And in 1922, we submit, Congress would have had in mind not protecting what would have been a layer in which the American trademark owner was simply the subsidiary of the foreign corporation. And the third...
How do we know that?
Well, because all the language in the legislative history speaks about protecting American manufacturers and producers from fraud.
Does anyone speak about not protecting others?
Well...
I mean, there's nothing in the legislative history that would exclude this situation.
There's nothing in the legislative history that says... except that the case that gave rise, of course, to this problem was one which involved a foreign manufacturer that had sold its rights to an American corporation. And if anything, the respondents are claiming this was xenophobic, but if anything, the indication is that the Congress was concerned about the American purchasers. Never was there the slightest suggestion that there was a wish to affect trademark law in some way. The respondents have talked about this as raising the principle of territoriality. That was not discussed in the legislative history. It was clear that what Congress was saying over and over again, we're protecting American purchasers from fraud.
You think we should only interpret statutes to resolve that one problem that prompted them? A lot of statutes that are prompted by a particular problem, but they're drawn more broadly. And later on, other things come along, and we don't go back and look at it and say, well, gee, it's just this one narrow problem that they had in mind. If they wrote a broader statute that covers more things, we say it covers them.
That's certainly true, Justice Scalia, but it is not true if what happens later on was wholly unanticipated. It's true, Congress can draw broad strokes and say that things that are out on the periphery, we're not going to deal with a specific exception. But if what happens is the growth of multinational corporations and the situation that's now presented by the gray market was not anticipated by the 1922 Congress, then it's appropriate that Congress look at what happened then. Congress did that exactly in the Wells Fargo case, decided about a month ago, when there was as clear a law as could possibly have been enacted, which said that certain obligations were free from all taxation now or hereafter imposed by the United States. And this Court said, no, let's look back in 1937. What was Congress looking at in 1937? Not estate taxes, even though the statute said all taxation now or hereafter, which would have included estate taxes. But the Court says we're looking at the history, we're looking at the context of what Congress could possibly have contemplated at the time.
We had one word in that case that we could interpret more narrowly that would produce the result that you wanted, the word taxation. Did taxes mean all of this, or did it mean somewhat less? What one word, or even two words, in this statute can you point to which, if giving a narrower interpretation, would produce the result here that you want?
I think it is the words owned by a citizen of or a corporation created or organized within the United States. And we think that that means not someone who is a subsidiary of a foreign corporation. But let me take slight issue with you, Justice Scalia. There were two words that were relevant. And I think it points up the question you asked Mr. Cohn. The words were all taxation, not taxation, but all taxation. And I believe that that is comparable to your analogy of all colors. The Congress said all taxes, not simply taxes, and yet this Court said estate taxes are somewhat different.
Well, as I understand the statute, it does restrict an American corporation if the American corporation licenses a foreign manufacturer and the goods somehow find their way back here.
And again,
So I point that out to you and ask you to comment on it in light of what you've just told Justice Scalia. And secondly, I would say that you began by saying Congress put in these words in the conference section, American corporation, and you somehow transpose that into an intent to protect the American consumer. I'm not so sure how that follows.
No, with regard to your second question, I'm speaking about an American corporation. In other words, not a corporation that's a subsidiary or an arm or a corporate agent of a wholly owned subsidiary of the foreign corporation. Our statute protects American consumers. Indeed, it protects many distributors who like my client and Kmart, who over the course of years have relied on customs interpretation, which did not spring out of the blue. It's been, in effect, these regulations were issued in 1970. They reflect what happened.
I'm talking just about the statute now.
Yes. Now, with regard to the American company, the American parent of the foreign corporation that produces abroad, we submit that was also not within Congress's contemplation, both in terms of that language and in terms of its limitation to articles of foreign manufacture. And when an American corporation is deliberately manufacturing abroad, Justice Kennedy, that American corporation is in control of its product. It makes a choice. Take Duracell or any of the companies that are cited. If it determines to produce a product abroad that looks identical to the product that it sells in the United States under the trademark in the United States, we're saying that that product, which it is in control of, the respondents argue that there's some form of unfair competition here because these companies should be able to rely on their own advertising in the United States. That company which manufactures the product abroad could manufacture a product that looked different in the foreign market. Duracell would have been able to do that. And yet it chose not to do so. It chose to create a worldwide market in which the product would look the same all over the world. And what we're saying is Customs in 1936 made clear that it did not view the statute as applying to the very same company that had both the production abroad and the trademark in the United States. Customs in 1936, when this whole multinational enterprise began to bloom somewhat, there was more movement within international commerce. The Customs Service at that point made its first statement in a regulation which appears here in the Joint Appendix, in which it said that that statute does not apply to the same owner. And we submit that language and that policy of Customs has been well known to Congress. It was known to Congress before the Lanham Act was passed in 1946. It was known to Congress throughout this entire period of time.
They just do it in the 30s. You mean there was really no international trade before that? I had thought that the Depression cut it down rather than expanded it. I would have thought when this statute was passed, there was probably a much brisker international trade, including multinational corporations, than there was later.
I think in terms of being able to get goods, the desirability of just even being able to move goods from across the Atlantic to the United States, I think was more difficult and less desirable. And in terms of having multinational corporations who would foreign, even if one takes the bourgeois case, the foreign manufacturer saw fit in that case to sell all its rights in the United States rather than try in some way to transport its goods to the United States and then attempt to make its own profits there. The record, I think, indicates that.
Thank you, Mr. Loon. We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I want to address myself first to what Mr. Cohen described as the central point of the case on the other side, the point that, as I understand, is thought to make it implausible that Congress meant what it said when it wrote Section 526. That is the idea that an owner of a trademark cannot prohibit the sale of goods bearing that trademark once unchanged, once he has first sold them or put them into commerce. But there really isn't any such first sale doctrine as insofar as international transactions are concerned. The doctrine just doesn't fit with the concept of territoriality of trademarks. Justice Holmes explained it in this court's opinion in the Katzel case to which you've heard reference this morning. He said it wasn't accurate to speak of the trademark on the face powder as distributed in the United States as being that of the French manufacturer of the trademark, even though it came from there. Because in law, he said, it is the trademark only of the United States bourgeois company in this country. And there are very solid factual reasons for this territorial view of trademarks. For one thing, products differ from country to country. Nothing sinister about those differences, nothing about which my clients need feel embarrassed. And the differences don't have anything to do either with whether the United States distributor or manufacturer of the products does or does not have corporate ties to the firm that makes the products for overseas distribution. Differences result simply from differing tastes, differing environmental conditions, differing laws, as well as the fact that goods intended for markets other than the United States may not be appropriately packed for shipment to the United States, or they may lack the United States distributor's valuable warranty on the goods, or difference as simple as the fact that fresh batteries made in the United States will make your flashlight light up, whereas batteries that are a long time in the shipping here and aren't meant to be won't make your flashlight light up. The fact of these differences between products intended for the United States market and products not intended for the United States market, intended for some other product, is one of the reasons why Section 526, if enforced as written, conforms fully with the policy of the trademark laws. One of those policies is to protect consumers against deception and confusion. And Section 526 would do that by ensuring that consumers were not imposed upon by products that were not quite the products they associate with familiar United States trademarks. Furthermore, Section 526, if enforced as written, would protect the trademark owner against erosion of his investment in the goodwill that is represented by the trademark. And that is the other principal goal of trademark law. In the kinds of goods we're concerned with here, the trademark owner makes heavy investments advertising and promoting his brand, quality assurance and service, both pre-sale and post-sale service. The gray market goods, the goods that come here, though not intended for the United States markets, do not bear the costs of those promotional and service investments and don't yield the trademark owner any return on them. I believe that I'm a biased listener, but I thought I heard it conceded this morning that Section 526 is written in terms broad enough to cover the cases that the Customs Service regulations deprive of its coverage. That seems to me to mean that the contested issues are whether Section 526 is fairly susceptible to a narrow reading, and not just any narrow reading, but a narrow reading that fits the Customs Service regulations, and at the same time keeps faith with the words that Congress chose. And second, whether there's any good reason in legislative history or elsewhere for reading the statute in that narrow way. I believe that the answer to both questions is a pretty resounding no. I'm going to take them up, plan to take them up in their logical order, text first, secondary sources second, even though the order of emphasis of petitioner's argument is just the opposite. If I hear them correctly, they say repeatedly and loudly that secondary sources indicate a congressional intent less sweeping than the words of the statute indicate. And then they add, and this almost had, again, I'm a biased listener, but it seemed to me it almost had to be dragged out of them this morning. Oh, yes, sotto voce, you can construe those words to accord with our view of congressional intent, even if you have to insert into the statutory text what Mr. Cohen in one of his papers calls an implicit contextual qualification. Seems to me that that argument is close to, if it is not, the same argument that was rejected by the court just last week in the Puerto Rico petroleum price regulation preemption case. That's an argument for what the court there described as giving effect to congressional intent in a vacuum, unrelated to the giving of meaning to an enacted statutory text. And as I hope to demonstrate, there is actually less to the appeal, even to secondary sources, than appears from all that petitioners say about it. But first the text. At the very least, one has to say it's uphill for the other side on the text. 30 years ago, the Solicitor General made a motion in this court to vacate a favorable judgment in the Gerlain antitrust perfume antitrust case, in which the meaning of Section 526 of the Tariff Act was an issue. In his motion, he said that he was bound to recognize that this interpretation, quotes, that was the district court's interpretation in the Gerlain case, which is very close, if not exactly the same as the Customs Service's current interpretation, is not supported by the literal terms of the statute. And there's been no relevant change in the statute in those 30 years.
Do you say, counsel, that the statute is not ambiguous in any respect, particularly the terms ownership and domicile? Those are non-ambiguous, self-defining, clear terms that admit of no gloss by the regulatory authorities?
I find no ambiguity in them. I plan to turn first to those two terms because it is on them that whatever textual argument is made is principally based. The terms of the statute are that the trademark, to be protected by Section 526, has to be owned by a corporation created within the United States and registered by a person domiciled in the United States. I don't find any ambiguity. But if there were any ambiguity, it would be resolved by finding the source of those terms in trademark law of the time. The requirement...
And so under trademark law, there can be only one owner of a patent, that this is some indivisible metaphysical core?
One owner of a trademark. Well, there was one owner of a trademark. And I should say about these two requirements of domicile and citizenship, they're owned by a citizen and registered by a person domiciled, they very considerably overlap. Because most U.S. citizens are domiciled in the United States, and most people who are domiciled in the United States are citizens of the United States.
and...
We're not really used to thinking of ownership or even of the term property as not as being indivisible, are we?
Well, I
the whole
think...
the whole bundle of sticks approach.
But it was used in those terms in the trademark statute. In the trademark statute, there was two categories of people were allowed to register the trademarks that they owned. This is the trademark, first section of the Trademark Act of 1905, Justice Kennedy. One category was a person domiciled in the United States. That person had to allege that he had used the trademark in commerce. The other kind of eligible registrant was a trademark owner that resided or was located in a foreign country that extended the privilege of trademark registration to United States citizens. In that case, if he had already registered the mark in the foreign country, he could register it in the United States without alleging use in commerce. The Section 526, as originally proposed, had only the requirement of domicile, of United States domicile, which I suggest was taken from directly from the trademark law and which had the very purpose of ensuring a trademark that was in use in the United States. The requirement of Section 526 that the trademark be owned by a United States citizen or a United States corporation was added in conference. In general, we tend to think that a corporation created in the United States is a corporation incorporated under one of the laws, under the laws of one of the states, and such a corporation, regardless of its parentage, I submit, is ordinarily regarded as the owner of what formally belongs to it. This court had decided in, I believe, 1909, cases arise, an omnibus case involving a number of cases arising under the Commodity Clause of the Hepburn Act of 1909. That statute forbade a railroad to carry coal that it owned or in which it had a direct or indirect interest. Volume 213, page 366 is the citation. The court rejected the argument of the government that the statute reached all coal nominally owned by mining company subsidiaries of railroads, not even the use by Congress of the phrase direct or indirect interest was enough to carry the day for the government on the commodities clause case. So there's no general rule, such as Mr. Lewin suggested, that under federal statutes that make the ownership of something by a corporation an operative fact, nominal ownership by a subsidiary corporation is attributed to the parent. The rule is quite to the contrary. There may be particular facts in particular cases that will justify looking through to the parent. And indeed, there were subsequent cases under the Commodities Clause where this court did just that. But the general rule, I submit, is as I have stated it.
Well, that's general, Mr. Allen, but not invariable. I can conceive of a statute that refers to the owner, which we might interpret to include the parent corporation of a wholly owned subsidiary. Can't you conceive that?
I can imagine there would, but I don't know why that would be so here. Ownership owned by was like domicile, a trademark concept. An applicant had to be the owner of his trademark, an applicant for registration. And he had to allege his citizenship. And he satisfies that obligation by stating under what jurisdiction the corporation was created, if the owner is a corporation. Doesn't ask a thing about the ultimate parentage.
Well, then you're saying that all of the proliferation of international corporations, subsidiaries, interlocking directorates, licenses to manufacture, sales of patents, are just irrelevant, and that we stick with the old concept that only one entity can own a patent.
I don't know why can own a trademark.
Can own a trademark.
I don't understand why not, Justice Kennedy, because we did know about things like that. The very Senate debate
then, at the very least,
knows that we knew about.
Then, at the very least, Congress has drawn a statute in the 1920s which simply does not accord with the modern reality.
It may or may not, Your Honor, but after all, one of the examples, in addition to the Katzel case that was offered on the Senate floor when Section 526 was being debated, was the Bayer Aspirin Company, which had been taken over by the alien property custodian during the war and sold to American interests. Why was it taken over by the alien property custodian? Because it was ultimately owned before the war by the German Bayer Company. That's why. And you had the senators talking about the multinational distribution of Pears soap. They knew that there were these kinds of things went on then, and they were known to the Congress. It is certainly very far from the failure to anticipate a certain application that might, I can conceive of, justify reading a statute in a narrow way. But this I submit, perhaps it is proliferated, as Your Honor says, but it was certainly not unknown to the Congress of 1922 that there could be intercorporate relations of this sort. And it drew for its concepts in writing this amendment to the Tariff Act dealing with trademarks. It drew upon the concepts used in the trademark law of the time. And I submit that when a Congress did indeed, as this Congress did, use the familiar words and concepts of the trademark registration statute, it would not have intended the Customs Service to apply a new, different, and unusual set of criteria in determining ownership, domicile, or corporate citizenship for the purposes of Section 526. And all of what I've said to this point, is quite aside from the case of American manufacturers and producers that are denied the protection of Section 526 by the Customs Service regulations with respect to goods that they or affiliates manufacture abroad. Ford Motor Company, Duracell, Procter & Gamble, Legions, examples.
And the American parent is the owner in all those instances?
Yes. That is the case I am putting, and there are many such cases, including those I have named. Those companies are obviously domiciled in the United States. They are certainly corporate citizens of the United States, and surely, they own their United States trademarks. It has been suggested that Congress.
The statute doesn't say United States trademark. It says trademark.
It says United States trademark. It says any merchandise of foreign manufacture that bears a trademark owned by a citizen of.
That's
united
not,
or corporation created within the United States.
You're saying that trademark is a concept in which ownership cannot be split.
Well, I don't think that.
And then you refer to United States trademark, and the statute doesn't say that.
Doesn't say United States. I was using that as shorthand to mean the trademark owned by a citizen of the United States and registered in the trademark office here by a citizen of the United States. And at least I suggest my latest words went only to those companies that are unquestionably American companies. And surely they are to be regarded as owners of the trademark that they use in the United States. It has been suggested that those companies are disqualified disqualified from the protection of the statute because the goods that they or their affiliates manufacture are not goods of foreign manufacture with another statutory term within the meaning of the statute. That just seems to me far-fetched textually, can't be squared with the reason why that qualification was put into the amendment, and it certainly can't be squared with the understanding that Congress had of the statute when it reenacted it in 1930. You may recall that in 1930, the Senate proposed to delete the provision of Section 526 that enables goods bearing a trademark owned by a citizen of the United States to be imported into the United States if the owner of the United States trademark gives its consent. The reason was to prevent American companies from establishing plants abroad, manufacturing their products there, and bringing them back into the United States. The understanding had to be that Section 526, as it was written, as it had been first enacted in 1922, applied to those companies. I simply don't see how there is another explanation of the Senate consideration of the statute when it was reenacted.
Let me just be sure I understand your point. There are two Duracell batteries. One's manufactured in the United States. The other's manufactured abroad under a trademark that has been sold or licensed to it. There is only one owner of that trademark?
There may be an owner in Belgium. There could be a separate owner in Belgium. But it's the
goods that have the trademark.
It is,
and there are two batteries, and each one's manufactured foreign, the other's manufactured U.S., and the owner of the trademark depends on where the batteries are?
The owner of the trademark that is registered in the United States and by a person domiciled in the United States has to be the trademark that is used in the commerce of the United States. Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And the same would work the other way around if it's a Sony product and the original owner is in Japan, but there's a man, I don't know if Sony manufactures.
A distributor. There is, in fact, in the case of Sony, there is manufacturing.
Even though the goods have been manufactured, two goods have been manufactured in different places and have a different trademark in the sense that a different manufacturing entity affixed it. There's only one owner to that trademark in all cases?
Only one owner in the United States, Your Honor. That's what the statute deals with, importing goods into the United States that bear a trademark owned by a citizen of the United States. The
The statute doesn't say United States trademark.
I did not say it that time. I didn't think, Justice Kennedy. But what it forbids is the importation of goods that bear the trademark that, as I say, is owned by a citizen created within the United States and registered in the trademark office by a person domiciled in the United States.
I don't quite understand your point, but your point is that can only be a United States trademark.
I have used the shorthand United States trademark. That can only be the United States trademark because it has to have been used in the commerce of the United States in those circumstances, yes.
And this is so clear that regulations aren't needed to clarify.
These regulations do not clarify that point, Your Honor. Perhaps I can get at it in a different way. It is perfectly permissible for a trademark in the for a trademark as it applies to goods that are in the commerce of the United States to be owned by and registered by the distributor of those goods and not the manufacturer. So take, for example, the Bourgeois Company of the Bourgeois and Castle. It owned in the United States the trademark for the French face powder, Java. What the least that Congress did and the least that this Court did was to say that the goods bearing that trademark, even though it was the authentic trademark in France and even though genuine, could not be imported into the United States to compete with the Bourgeois Company's goods bearing the trademark that it owned in the United States and had registered in the United States. In that sense only do I argue that there can only be one owner of the trademark. There can be multiple owners of a trademark insofar as it is used in different countries. It is only the case of that sort of multiple ownership that the Customs Service regulations say that Section 526 applies to. I say it applies even though, and the words of the statute, I submit, bear me out, it applies even though that trademark in France, Japan, wherever it may be, is owned by a company affiliated with the owner of the trademark who has used it in the commerce of the United States and has registered it with the Patent and Trademark Office.
So goods that have a French trademark suddenly have a U.S. trademark the minute they land in New York.
They cannot be brought into the United States because that trademark is the trademark of the American owner of the trademark only in the United States, as Justice Holmes phrased it. And that is the least we know from the statute and the least we know from the Katzel case itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Cohen, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Treasury Department has, for 50 years, drawn a line between a stranger's goods and the trademark owner's own goods in the interpretation of Section 526. And I suggest that there is ample room in this statute and in the Court's jurisprudence to sustain a regulation with that history. Justice Holmes' opinion for the Court in the Prestonetz case in 1923 said, "A trademark only gives the right to prohibit the use of it so far as to protect the owner's goodwill against the sale of another's product as his." Skipping a citation, there is nothing to the contrary in Bourgeois v. Katzel, this Court's decision in that case. I suggest that there is also nothing to the contrary in the federal statute that was passed to do the same thing that this Court did in its decision in Katzel, which was to plug a hole that had permitted the importation of infringing goods. Section 526 was a modest statute enacted to correct a mistake. Congress thought an American firm had been cheated by somebody over there. It did not achieve any importance. There were very few cases under it until recent years, and really the strong dollar of the late 1970s and 80s, prompted this and other lawsuits seeking to turn the statute into something that it had never been, namely a help to multinational companies in imposing vertical restraints on the distribution of their own goods. Batteries may be stale because they are made in France. They may also be stale because they are made in California and shipped here. A firm plainly has no right, merely because it has applied its trademark to the goods in California, to prevent their being sold here. There is no reason to believe that this statute was designed to give that firm, which cannot keep its California goods out of Maryland, a right to keep its own French goods out of Maryland.
Mr. Cohen, let's assume that that description by Justice Holmes applies here, that it only protects against the goods of another.
Yes.
But like many of your distinctions based on the statutory language or even the dicta of Holmes, that covers some of the provisions of the regulation here, but not all. And among the things that Customs Office has read out of the statute is number C3. The articles of foreign manufacture bear a recorded trademark or trade name applied under authorization of the United States owner. They are not the United States owner's goods, but he has allowed somebody else to put a trademark on them.
May I respond briefly? This case is a facial challenge to the regulation. The core case under the regulation has been since 1936 the case where the same company is involved. If Copiat concedes that that the Treasury can draw a distinction between takes care of the same company case, I suggest they have lost this case. They can bring another case saying that the Treasury has drawn the line in not quite the right place. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument now and